Hello there. My name is Lance Lichter. I'm the web editor for the Journal of Anesthesiology and speaking to Dr. Francis Chung. How are you today?
Oh, very good, thanks.
And thanks so much for talking to us. And we're going to talk about your article, Obesity Hypoventilation Syndrome, a review of epidemiology, pathophysiology, and perioperative considerations. The first question, how did you get interested in the problem of obesity hypoventilation syndrome?
One of my research interests is in the obstructive sleep apnea. And we were actually looking at obstructive sleep apnea and the bicarbonate, and we saw some interesting correlations in the bicarbonate and also the apnea hypopnea index. So we are working on that as part of our research program. And I looked deeper into it, and I felt there is probably the obesity hypoventilation syndrome, which is a syndrome which affects 0.15% to 0.3% of the general populations. And we are not very familiar with this syndrome as anesthesiologists, and with the prevalence of morbid obesity in North America being at 30%, this will be increasingly an issue for the anesthesiologist and surgeon. And that is why we decide to do a systematic review on this problem.
So let's say you see a patient in the preoperative clinic. How would you screen the patient?
So a lot of time, I think the history is very important, and we propose that the patients probably, if it's suspicious, then the patient should be screened by the stop-bang questionnaire. The stop-bang questionnaire has 8 questions, which is the stop is actually essentially, do you have a very history of loud snoring and loud enough to be heard behind closed door? And then T represents tiredness, sleepiness in the daytime, is daytime somnolence. You have that, and fatigue, daytime somnolence and tiredness in the daytime. And then O is anybody observe you stop breathing. And then P is do you have a history of high blood pressure? The bang, B-A-N-G, B represent body mass index more than 35, age more than 50, and then neck circumference more than 40, and then G is the male gender. So 3 out of 8 questions positive, the patient is positive at risk of having obstructive sleep apnea. And the higher the score of stop bang, the more significant it is to have obstructive sleep apnea. So we actually, because suspected obesity hypoventilation patients, they are different from the obstructive sleep apnea because they actually have composed of hypoxemia, so their oxygen saturation is less than 90%, and their BMI index often is very high, 40, and also they have very high daytime hypercapnia, so their PaCO2, the carbon dioxide in the daytime, is more than 45. So it's 3 components: large body mass index, hypoxemia in the daytime, and also daytime hypercapnia. So these patients constitute obesity hypoventilation syndrome. So they are a subgroup of patients that actually will have problem, more likely to have problem for the anesthesia. And a lot of the bariatric patients, they're walking around and they may function, but if they come for operations and anesthesia, they can have an issue because they have obesity hypoventilation syndrome. They are not diagnosed. So I would essentially say we should screen using stop bang questionnaire. We should measure the patient's oximetry and also see whether the patient has elevated serum bicarb, or if you can do a blood gas, do a bicarb. So the patient actually who have high risk for obesity hypoventilation syndrome are those who have stop bang more than 3 or equal to 3, and their oxygen saturations is less than 90% on oximetry, and they have elevated bicarbonate.
Now, let's say you've determined that the patient has obesity hypoventilation syndrome. What would you do with the patient before the day of surgery?
So I think for these patients, depends on the patient. If they're really coming for major elective surgery and they're not treated, and we do have to refer them to sleep medicine, because then they can do a polysomnography, they can have PAP therapy titrations. And I think that's important so that they are treated, because these patients run into problem afterwards. If it is emergency surgery, then really you can, it's important the patient have surgery. Then you have to practice some of the pre-op precautions for obstructive sleep apnea. Essentially, they are these are potential difficult airway. Make sure the patient has short-acting medications so that they will have very rapid emergence. And make sure that we are aware that these patients may have opioid-induced ventilatory impairment and that these patients may have to be put on PAP therapy afterwards.
So let's say the patient isn't using positive airway pressure therapy preoperatively. Would you recommend they start?
Yes, for sure.
How long should they be on it before the operation?
So actually, there's no research on this area. For patients, actually, there are some research on survival. So with the patient that obesity hyperventilation syndrome, if they actually are on PAP therapy, their survival is good. However, if they're obesity hyperventilation syndrome and they're not treated and they have severe cases, actually they have 20% mortality at 1 year. So it's very significant on their lifespan. So the literature, the research on when to start PAP therapy for either obstructive sleep apnea patients or obesity hyperventilation syndrome patients for surgery, the duration is not really well defined in the literature. For history of treatment of hypertension, if they are hypertension, it can be reversed in 1 month, the effect of PAP therapy. However, there are some indication that even if they are on PAP therapy for 1 day, they can reduce the edema in the airway, so it's useful. I would say that probably common sense dictate if they can start for a few days, it would be better for the patient because it would decrease the inflammation of the airway, reduce the edema of the airway, ensure the patient has a better periop outcome. But the evidence is not there because there is no formal research.
Yes. Now, there is some controversy about use of depth of anesthesia monitors, but would you recommend their use for such patients? Because duration of anesthesia, as you indicated, is important.
Yeah, I think it is very important to use rapid and short-acting anesthetic. And I do believe that monitoring of the level of anesthesia will help to make sure the patient is optimized.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any other thoughts?
I think it is important that in these patients, if they may have pulmonary hypertension, they may have right ventricular hypertrophy. And so these patients, if they have a ECG pre-op, they may require ECG pre-op so that you can actually see the patient to see whether they have right axis deviation, right ventricular hypertrophy, or left ventricular hypertrophy and problem of hypertension. It is important because this will tell you, and sometimes the chest x-ray will show you the increased pulmonary vasculature as well. So in these patients, sometimes you may have to do an echo or stress test in these cases for further workup to see the component whether they have pulmonary hypertension, because those are the things that will give us trouble.
Indeed. All right. Well, thank you very much.